It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of a new book looks at the long-term impact of many young people choosing to leave their small-town roots behind in search of other cultural and economic opportunities. First, after two mass shootings in a week, President Biden is urging Congress to pass gun control legislation. 2 weeks ago, the House passed two bills that would broaden background checks on gun buyers. Earlier this week, Biden called on the Senate to follow suit. He also called for a ban on assault-style weapons.
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act.
The White House also said Biden is considering using his executive powers to address the problem of gun violence. Meanwhile, Democrats and Republicans are at odds over what to do about immigration and Biden's $3 trillion infrastructure and climate change concept. A Democratic member of Wisconsin's congressional delegation joins us now for a look at these and other issues. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see from Congress when it comes to responding to shootings, mass shootings, and other gun violence? Are tougher gun laws the answer or not? What do you want to see Congress do about border issues and immigration? And what do you think about the idea of spending trillions of dollars over the next 10 years on infrastructure and climate initiatives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Pocan is the Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. That includes Madison and other parts of South Central Wisconsin. We reached out to all of the state's Republican members of Congress. They either said they couldn't do it or haven't replied yet, so watch this space. Representative Pocan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the issue of gun violence and these public mass shootings in particular after the tragedies in Boulder, Colorado, Atlanta, Georgia, and the surrounding area. Do you have thoughts on what it could take to stop mass shootings like this from happening?
Yeah, political courage by politicians that all too often are honestly heavily persuaded, a.k.a. bought and sold by the National Rifle Association. We need people to realize that you can do something as an elected official. You can do common sense background checks and other measures that we recently passed in Congress that have up to 90% almost public support, and yet we still can't get them done because of one special interest. And we need political courage from more people.
Can you talk more about what the background check laws that you passed on your side of the chambers would actually do?
Well, you know, there's a big giant loophole in if you buy a gun from a reputable dealer, you have to have a background check. But when you buy something off of Craigslist or some other ad and you meet someone in a parking lot at a grocery store and give them cash and you get something in a bag, you can transfer a gun that way. And that shouldn't be. You should have the same background checks no matter how you sell a gun. And, you know, it's simple other measures like that that, again, have wide public support. But yet we still can't get them through Congress because too many people are too heavily persuaded by special interests.
I want to give a listen to Republican Senator Ted Cruz talking at a Senate hearing yesterday. He says we need to go after the perpetrators themselves. Here's a listen.
Let's target the bad guys, the felons, the fugitives, those with mental disease. Let's put them in jail. Let's stop them from getting guns. Let's not scapegoat innocent law-abiding citizens, and let's not target their constitutional rights.
So, Representative Pocan, a lot of people who would never perpetrate a crime like this, Senator Cruz and others say, would be hurt, their lives would be impacted by some of the laws you're talking about, the expanded background checks and others. What do you say to that?
It's completely ridiculous. That's why I say too many people, quite honestly, are bought and sold by the gun special interests, the manufacturers, the people that don't want to have the very background checks that almost everyone in Wisconsin who has a gun is law-abiding. And we want to make sure that, you know, buying from a dealer is much better with a background check than having this where you can, you know, buy something online and meet someone with a bag of cash and do a transfer in a parking lot. So, you know, we're trying to really impact all of those folks who are law-abiding, including the gun dealers who already follow the law. And it's Ted Cruz who would rather, you know, pander and meander into this kind of rhetoric rather than, stand up to the special interest. So, you know, again, almost 90% of the people agree with us on this issue. It should be a no-brainer, except when, you know, the special interests in Washington are involved.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Nicola is with us in Lafarge. Nicola, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, just this whole gun stuff, it seems like it's over and over, and we're really the country that's got the biggest issue. And I understand, you know, people don't want to have their guns taken away. I mean, I've owned a gun. I live in a hunting area, which is very different than the cities. But it makes no sense to me why someone would want to have an automatic weapon. I just don't see it, a need for it other than to kill people. And what about just having a ban on buying any new ones? And then also that, you know, of reselling any old ones. Seems like that would be at least one step we could do. And I'm just really surprised about these gun shows where people can, you know, retail guns with no paper trail.
Hope you're breaking up there, Nicola. We take your point. Just in the interest of precision, automatic weapons, fully automatic weapons, are mostly, almost completely illegal for sale, except for some collectors. But I think she's referring to what people call assault-style weapons with still fairly high rates of fire, often with larger ammunition capacity. Representative Pocan, do you see a need for changes in laws when it comes to those kind of firearms?
You know, I think that's what the president called for, right? You know, every time you look at one of these shootings, the AR-15 comes up over and over and over and over. And, you know, it's not a hunting rifle. It is a weapon that can cause the type of death that we've seen, whether it be Colorado or other places. So, you know, I know the president has called for that. That's not what we've passed so far in the House of Representatives, but it is legislation that has been introduced. And I think, you know, it's worthy of a debate.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Andrew with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to say, Andrew?
Well, I wanted to, one, point out a factual inaccuracy about the comments that the guest just made about how a AR-15-style rifle cannot be used for hunting. Those particular rifles are available in a large number of calibers that can very easily be used for dropping a deer and or bigger game. So to say that they cannot be used for hunting is not accurate. But secondly, the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting whatsoever. So to tie all of those together, it doesn't make sense. It's not material to the matter of the Second Amendment at all.
Andrew, thanks for the call. And Representative Pocan, I mean, that is something that gun control efforts run up against. The Second Amendment seems to, and courts often interpret it as putting pretty strict limits as to how far you can go with gun control. Not completely saying you can't have it at all, but it's kind of a barrier. How do you regulate guns without running afoul of it?
Sure. Well, there was lots wrong with the last comments. One, I mean, people just don't hunt with AR-15s. It's just something that's not used. And to say because you can use it, well, sure, you could use a bazooka to get a deer. I doubt most people would, but I don't think that's an argument to give, you know, the public bazooka guns. But that's essentially the argument the person made. On the Second Amendment, you know, certainly we can curtail things like making sure that there's a background check. There's absolutely no limits on that. And don't forget, when we had the Second Amendment, you had muzzle guns. It took a while to load a gun for a single shot. And now we have weapons that are considerably different. So to say that somehow the Second Amendment is saying that's not what this is for is just dead wrong. And, you know, I know people like to somehow claim that we're violating the Second Amendment, but it's very clear that the measures that we're talking about, things like background checks and other common sense measures, certainly don't do that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mark Pocan, Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. We've been talking about guns and gun control so far. We've got another conversation about that today as well. We'll also move on to some other issues, including immigration and infrastructure spending and the pandemic. You can join in on those concerns with your questions, your hopes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the issues facing Congress right now. We've talked some about gun control. Now we'll turn to immigration, COVID-19, and infrastructure. Mark Pocan stays with us, Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Representative Pocan, an increase in the number, especially of younger asylum seekers, kids seeking asylum in the U.S. at the Mexico border, a big topic of the press conference President Biden held earlier today. As far as what Congress in particular can do, this has been going on for decades now. What would you like to see happen in your branch of government?
Well, you know, when I first came to Congress, got elected in 2012 and 2013-14 session, the Senate had a bipartisan bill that had nearly 70 votes that had both protections at the borders as well as a pathway to citizenship for aspiring Americans. You know, I think we need to get back to that. The problem is the rhetoric for the last 4 years has been extremely xenophobic under the Trump administration. It's harder to get to a place that we need to. But the reality is we have millions and millions of people who are here, many of which have been here maybe since they were weeks or months old. We have to have a policy to actually address that, in addition to addressing some of the current issues that we've had for the last several decades at the border. And, you know, doing nothing does just that. It does absolutely nothing. And I think we need to have, again, more political leaders standing up and actually talking about that type of reforms that we saw with that nearly 70 votes that happened just not that many years ago.
We just talked on the show yesterday about something that passed in the House of Interest here in Wisconsin, a bill that would give a path to legal status and ultimately over time, maybe to citizenship for farm workers, immigrant farm workers in Wisconsin. Again, it passed the House, not the Senate, not yet anyway. Could you share some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we can keep doing these piece by piece. But the fact that we were able to do something comprehensively not that many years ago, you know, ideally that would be the way to go. There's no question. I think there's wide public support for people who are the so-called DACA recipients, people who've been here, again, as I said, since they were weeks or maybe months old and don't even speak the language of the country they came from. You know, we need to deal with these issues. But I think we also could deal with them in a comprehensive way. It's not that hard, other than the last 4 years made a lot of the rhetoric very difficult around it. So I'm just hoping that political leaders will be just that, leaders, and figure out how we can have these bigger conversations that are absolutely necessary.
Let's go back to our callers. John in Pewaukee has an issue to bring up. John, hi.
Well, hello. You hear me?
Yep. Go for it, John.
Well, I don't know if you want to talk about health care or you want to talk about immigration. I can comment on both.
Are you healthcare sounds like what you wanted to talk about, John. Go for it.
Okay. There was a wonderful program that's about 10 years old on PBS called Stick Around the World, and they went around to five different countries, a reporter, and talked about healthcare. And four of them, they all had socialized medicine, but they all had different types, which shocked me because I thought socialized medicine was one deal. And one of the things that came up is by watching it is like four of them have – they all have like a – you know, like you have the EPA, which is in charge, not in charge of making electricity, but in charge of regulating how it's made. They all have something like an HPA, for lack of a better term, a healthcare protection agency, where it regulates healthcare, but it doesn't make it. It leaves it up to the private, but they sort of are a check against it, where, you know, there are haves and wants. You need a cure for cancer, you want a cure for baldness. So baldness cure, you can charge whatever you want, but the cancer cure, they regulate how much you can charge on it and stuff like that.
I gotcha. I think I got you, John. We don't have too much time. Representative Pocan, on health care, it sounds like John's saying, hey, let's have a regulated utility. I mean, we kind of have that, a private system with federal regulation. Are there changes you think we need, though?
Well, and essentially, you know, in many ways, what he's describing is very similar to Medicare, right? And that's why many of us have said we should have a Medicare for all system. It's a single payer system still run by private entities and private doctors. So, you know, much of the rhetoric around socialized medicine, I'm glad the caller said it just the way he did. You know, the rhetoric is that it's something very different than what it is. It's still having private providers. It's just having a single payer system. So you take out the layers of bureaucracy that take out too much money that's not actually directly healthcare. So, you know, that's what Medicare is. It's a wildly popular program at the federal level. And I'm one who says we should do that for everyone.
in this country.
Thanks for that call. Infrastructure looks like it could be one of the next big hot topics. Thoughts about a $3 trillion-ish plan over 10-ish years. What kind of things would you be looking for in an infrastructure package?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, I think, you know, we should be celebrating one of the biggest bills that went through Congress in the last several decades, the American Rescue Plan, that not only got checks to people, but gets people into jobs, it gets shots into arms, it gets kids back into school. It's a huge bill that has not, you know, really, for as big as it is, it should be talked about more. The infrastructure bill will also help stimulate the economy by investing in our infrastructure. And it looks like it may be a little later than we originally thought. It might be more like September, but that gives us time to make sure that we're investing not just in roads and bridges, but schools and broadband and water delivery systems and housing and all sorts of infrastructure. Personally, I'd like to see it even more robust. That $3 trillion over 10 years is about 1% of our gross domestic product, and all the experts have said we should be investing at least 2% in. So I would be happier with a bigger bill. But it will really help jumpstart the economy as we're doing all this work to end COVID. I think it's really crucial.
In our last minute and a half or so, your thoughts on the filibuster in that other chamber over there, the Senate. Should it stay or should it go?
You know, I think that's a debate they should have. Personally, I'm on the side of it's a very arcane rule that if you can't pass something with a majority like you do in the House and every legislature I know of and every local government entity, it just doesn't make sense that you can have things blocked by a 60-vote rule. So I would hope that they would look at filibuster reforms so we can get even more done. That American Rescue Plan was huge, and people will feel the impact for months and months and years, really, on that bill. But if we want to do other things like protect people's ability to vote, and if we want to address some of the things like with gun legislation and a lot of other issues, we're going to need to get rid of the filibuster in order to do that. So I hope that they have that debate in the Senate.
Do you worry that 2025 elections have flipped things? Republicans have a narrow majority in the Senate, the House, and control the White House. Do you worry about the impact of making changes now?
Well, you know, they already got around it for a bunch of things when they were in charge, right? So the problem with Democrats, I think, all too often is we try to completely play by the rules and not suggest a change like this that the Republicans have already done. And now they say, well, you shouldn't change it, even though they in their actual practice did that. I think it's time for Democrats to be as effective as Republicans have in yielding power. And in this case, we're asking for things that don't benefit special interests like the Republicans when they passed that giant tax cut where 83% of the money went to the top 1%. But we're trying to do things that actually get the economy going and help get people vaccines. So I would argue Democrats need to be a little bigger and bolder. And in this case, maybe follow what the Republicans have already done, not their rhetoric.
Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Mark Pocan is the Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District in Madison and beyond. We talked to him about the Democrats' push for more gun control, infrastructure spending, and more. We also invited members of Wisconsin's Republican delegation to join us today. They were either unavailable or didn't reply. We'll keep trying in the future, though. Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. In October, Paul Mathis got COVID-19. He lost his sense of taste and smell and slept a lot. Overall, the 49-year-old Rib Mountain man had a mild case of the disease. Except he didn't get better. Mathis is one of the 10% or so of people with long-haul COVID whose symptoms persist for months. He started writing about his experience on social media. He read back through some of those posts and shared his reflections with WPR.
October 25th, 2020. So it's been a full week since I first lost all sense of taste and smell and was mostly convinced that I was COVID positive. Today marks two full weeks since I lost. Today is the 22nd day since I had my first symptom that made me fear my diagnosis. Still no change with my occasionally racing heart and becoming easily winded. This is getting old really fast. That wins me. Got to take a break. When I go back and look at all those posts and read them from start to finish, which I do from time to time, a lot of the stuff that I talked about, you know, on day one, on day, you know, 8, day 15, whatever, I'm still experiencing. Let's see, 13, what is today, Thursday? Today is day 117. Even though I'd heard the phrase long hauler and knew that it was, you know, people having symptoms and complications, you know, well after when they were diagnosed, a part of me assumed that it was from people that had had it pretty heavily, the ones that required hospitalization. But it wasn't until, you know, after about the, you know, third week of not having taste or smell, where you start Google how long do COVID patients, you know, lose their sense of taste and smell. I mean, you're trying to discover, you know, like, when's it going to come back? Does it come back? You know, is this permanent? There are other people that still can't, you know. So you start doing searches like that, and that's when I really stumbled across long haulers and what long haulers, you know, entails. November 15th, 2020. I have this weird clinical clean scent that is slightly sweet and metallic. My heart still continues to occasionally race for no reason whatsoever, and I still become easily winded. I did taste some raw red onions on a burger this week. I'm just able to pick up the mildest of scents of deep blue, icy hot, and ground cloves, but only when I'm snorting it like Tony Montana in Scarface. This hits me. I mean, you know, looking back at it, you just wonder, I mean, is this a permanent thing? I don't claim to have any kind of extreme case whatsoever. I think I've had it very mildly. And I really feel for people that have had it, you know, much, much worse. I've known people that have had it much, much worse. I've known people that have passed from this. November 15th, 2020. December 20th, 2020. Day 64, January 31st, 2021. Day 106. Still no change with my occasionally racing heart and becoming easily winded. No progress of note. I just think of all the other people, like I said, that still have it worse. I'm still walking. I might be puffing. So I count myself lucky, but at the same time, you just kind of wonder, is this the new normal? Is this just going to be the way it is? You know, did it take days, weeks, months, years off of whatever lifespan I had? I mean, who knows? I think that's kind of like the biggest question mark, and the anxiety around it is for people that, you know, are still experiencing symptoms of, where am I going to be in a year?
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up after the news, when you move away from your hometown, do you still feel connected to it? And do you ever want to move back? The author of the new book, Uprooted, looks at the emotions we attach to the places we grew up. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Many young people who grow up in rural communities choose to leave as young adults, maybe for college or different opportunities, and few make plans to return, at least anytime soon. In her new book, our next guest explores what it means to leave behind our roots and how modern ideas of what it means to be successful, economic opportunity, self-improvement, growth, often leave small communities out of the conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you living in the place where you were raised? If so, did you leave and come back, or have you chosen to stay all along? If you chose to leave, what do you feel if and when you go back to visit? And do we need to do a better job at creating bonds and communities that make people want to stay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Grace Olmsted is a journalist who focuses on farming, localism, and family. Her writing has been published in places like the American Conservative and the New York Times. Her new book is called Uprooted: Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. Grace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted I get to be with you.
And you tell the story of a lot of communities and people, and one of those people is you. Can you share a little bit of your story and how you left and then revisited your community?
Absolutely. I grew up in small town Idaho, in a town of about 3,000 people, and was a part of a family that had lived in Idaho since the turn of the century. I'm pretty sure my great-great-great-grandfather homesteaded there in about 1904. But I left to go to college on the East Coast in Virginia and ended up getting a job and marrying someone in the Air Force and just stayed out on the East Coast. But the longer I was away from home, the more homesick I became, and the more I began to consider how my roots in Idaho made me who I am. And so as I started to work on some projects revolving around agriculture, I decided to take all my research and my homesickness back to Idaho with me and to talk to people in my home community and to find out how people were doing there and what was going on in that small community after I had left it behind.
Grace, I feel like I could go through your book, cross out the word Idaho and write Wisconsin in, and it would still make a lot of sense to people here. Can you talk a little bit about farming in your hometown, how it's changed over the years? It's going to sound familiar, I think, to a lot of people here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, agriculture in Idaho has continued to grow more concentrated as family farms have either grown in size or disappeared with time. You see a lot of farmers struggling to make ends meet as they deal with changes in markets and in agribusinesses that put extra pressures on them. They have increasing input costs along with a narrowing profit margins that have really made it difficult to keep the farm alive. And in addition to that, you have a lot of young people growing up in these communities who have no interest in either inheriting a family farm or perhaps doing the work of starting a farm themselves. And so a lot of farm towns are seeing an aging generation of farmers and a decreasing prospect of future farmers raised in the land where they were originally from. And so in the town that I profile, the number of children younger than 18 living in Emmett continues to decline. The median age is always going up. And a lot of the high schoolers that I talk to in my book say that they don't have any intention of staying in the town or in the surrounding area once they graduate high school.
And a real core to that is if you, high school kid, want to be successful in life as defined in a number of different ways, you can do it, but you can't really do it here. Can you talk about that lack of a path, a vision for people to grow into a life they want in the town they grew up in?
Absolutely. I think part of that has to do with a growing lack of economic opportunity in rural towns as mom and pop businesses and other regional sources of economic strength go away. But there's also a lot of cultural messages we receive as young people that tell us if we're successful or smart, we need to leave. You know, there's always that saying you hear, you'll go far, which is a compliment, whereas the idea of settling is usually a bad thing. And so we have a lot of messages surrounding exodus if you're growing up in rural America. But I contrast that in my book to the life of my great-grandfather, who was born in the town where he eventually died. He lived all 96 years of his life in the same region, indeed, probably within the same about 10 to 20 mile radius. And so that was a remarkable legacy. And what's interesting to me is that it was never seen as a bad thing. In fact, it was a sign of his success. And he was kind of a local hero for a lot of people, someone everyone looked up to. And so for him, staying in place for his entire life was a good thing, and it was something people praised him for. And so I kind of tried to look at how things have changed and why it is that now, if someone were to live all 96 years of their life in one spot, we wouldn't necessarily see them as a success story.
We're talking to Grace Olmsted about her new book, Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. You could join in if any of this sounds familiar to you, to your family, to your community at 800-642-1234. Grace, let's tackle now this central concept in your book, the idea of being rooted. What do you mean by that in this day? It might not look like that 96-year stay in the same city, but what does it mean to capture that idea of being rooted in the community we live in?
Well, I think very essential to that idea is that even if you're not living in the community where you grew up, you are a very a given member of that society. You love your place, you care for it in the way that you live, in the way that you're involved in the life of the community, and you understand some of the things that make it special and that make it particularly needful of your presence. One thing I really wanted to emphasize as I worked on this book is that many places need us and they need our membership. And yet in America today, we've kind of emphasized this idea of rootlessness, that we are best served by constant mobility and transience. But Simone Weil, who is a famous French philosopher, once wrote that actually in the great need to be rooted, that to be rooted is perhaps the most important and least recognized need of the human soul. And so the idea of rootedness is meant to just combat the idea that every place is interchangeable with other places, and that we can easily abandon places that might need us in a deeper sense. And loving place, I think, involves being a faithful, rooted member of our societies and communities and looking for ways that we can give to them, even as they, in many ways, can give back to us.
I wanted to get into a couple things that you're not saying in the book. And one of those things is you're not saying, I think, is this is inevitable, that this decline has to happen. You highlight the stories of some people who have gone into farming in new places, in the places they grew up, whatever the case might be, who are doing things in a new way that might paint a pathway forward. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was very honored to get to talk to a lot of people who are perhaps returners, as they're called, people who left Emmett, Idaho for other places throughout the U.S. for college and then eventually found their way back home, as well as newcomers from places like California who are bringing their talents and skill sets with them and planting them in the soil of this farm community. So I profile a farm that is raising fruits and vegetables on the outskirts of Emmett and works at the major farmers markets in and around the town. And that's very committed to growing opportunities to have local food sovereignty and health in place through their work, as well as a farm that's doing a regenerative beef operation, pasture raised beef that then goes to a lot of farmers markets as well as a large local population in Emmett. And both of these farms are just a couple of examples of people who are very excited about growing opportunity in Emmett, feeding a local population, and making sure that farms don't go away.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Addie is with us in Eau Claire. Addie, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Addie?
So I'm a senior this year, and I go to a small rural town school. And so the attitude behind the jobs that your guest is describing is, like, she's really negative and almost kind of like those jobs are for people that are less intelligent. And I've noticed, like, as senior this year with, like, pushing us towards careers, those careers been mentioned at all, and that hasn't been, that's more seen as a, if you aren't smart enough or you can't afford college, then you decide on this, but that's almost disappointing.
Addie, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, you wrote about, I can't remember who said it in your book, Grace, but something like, yeah, my counselor almost, you know, passed out when I said I wanted to stay in town or work at a farm or something like that. People like Addie and others steered away from those jobs that they could actually get in that community.
And it's crazy to me because if you look at the actual work of being a farmer, it requires such intelligence and diligence and study. And every time I've been out in the fields talking to a farmer, I realize how little I know about what they do and that it would take a lifetime to be able to accomplish all that they have. I think we need to emphasize with greater and greater ability as we're able, just how important it is to have our best and brightest students out working the land. It's where our food comes from. It's going to be absolutely vital for ongoing environmental conservation. And it's such a wonderful opportunity for young people to see how they can bring their talents to bear in their home communities and grow a lot of health as a result.
Addie, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Grace Olmsted. Her new book is called Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in this position, deciding whether to leave or stay in your smaller hometown? How do you think the loss of family farms has impacted your community and the connections you feel in it? What do you think needs to happen to recreate some of this feeling of rootedness wherever you might live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with journalist Grace Olmsted. Her new book is called Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you leave the place you grew up? Maybe a small town, maybe a large city. Do you think about going back? Did you go back at some point? Or do you feel like you've put down roots wherever you are right now? What did it take to do that? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Connie is with us in Wausau. Connie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Connie?
Well, I am 75, and I didn't go to college until I was older in life, and I lived in St. Louis, got my undergrad and master's there, and at age 50, moved to Cincinnati to get my PhD in urban history. So I find this topic truly amazing. I write, still my history that I write about is St. Louis, and I go back there for research. I actually thought when I retired, I would move back there. It's still home to me. That's what I call home. I cross over the bridge and see that arch, and I know I'm home even after 25 years. But I'm staying in Wisconsin, in Wausau, Wisconsin, because I have a son who is divorced, and we are moving to Marshfield and buying a house together so I can help him with his kids. But I get this feeling, and I love the book, I Wish I Were Still Teaching, because the books that I would use in class are about city living and small town living, and teaching in Wisconsin with the rural life up here, I think it would have been a perfect crossover to bring that in as well. And I love the idea. To me, home is where your heart is.
Connie, thank you so much. St. Louis's loss is our gain here in Wisconsin. Grace, I don't know, she kind of did this in reverse a little bit, but still that she's not in the place that her heart is, and she has that yearning for it.
And I think it's important to look for ways that that yearning, even if we can't move home, can just sculpt the way we live in the places we're in now. I talk at the end of my book about how nostalgia oftentimes can be a really hard emotion to deal with because there's often some grief in it, depending on how much we miss people who've also passed away in the places we've left behind. But in nostalgia, I think we can tap into some good questions about what inspires us about the places where we used to live? How do they continue to inspire the way we live if it's a different place? How can the gifts and the lessons we learned in our home communities serve the places we live in now? And so I think it's a beautiful thing, actually, to be able to bring those lessons with you to wherever you currently live.
Thanks a lot for that call. Patrick joins us next in Madison. Patrick, hello.
Hello. Yes, this is Patrick, and I'm really excited to be listening to this guest of yours. I am an immigrant from West Africa, and some friends of mine and myself have joined together to create a farm here where we can grow indigenous crops, food crops that fellow immigrants can relate to, you know. And so when your guests talk about going back to Idaho to join the agricultural community, I can relate to that very much because that's exactly what we are planning to do. I just want some words of encouragement from your guest, and let me know how I can get her book.
Patrick, thanks for the call. The title again is Uprooted, and to Patrick and his friends, but literally and figuratively putting down new West African roots here in Wisconsin, Grace.
Oh, such wonderful work, and thank you, Patrick, for doing it. I think if we're going to see farms flourish in the days and years to come, it's going to be people like you who are putting down roots and who are teaching the rest of us as well how to grow food in better and more sustainable ways.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Keith in Black River Falls. Keith, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm somebody that's made that return journey. I grew up on a dairy farm and in a small community of 3,000 plus, moved off to college, lived many different places, even overseas, eventually ended up in the Madison area where I met my wife, was from Chicago, and we would occasionally come back to my hometown for different holidays and visit with relatives. And it was actually she and our tomboy daughter who fell in love with the farm community that I came from And that compelled us to kind of shake off the hustle and bustle of the Madison area and move back. And while we're not hugely engaged in the agricultural community personally, we were very much connected with that again. And my wife, as I said, grew up in Chicago, but she found a sense of community that she'd never had in any of the places that she lived. And I joke with her that she should have been born 100 years ago to a frontier wife, frontier farmer, cooking for 10 or 15 people. She just loves it in this community.
Keith, I got to ask, had you thought of moving back there, or did this all come from your wife and daughter?
I always had, you know, fond thoughts of my hometown, but I never actively thought of moving back.
Huh.
So it really was her, it was the impetus from her that caused it to happen. And I'm so glad it happened. There's so many things that I really didn't recognize as a youth that I appreciate so much more as an adult. I have come to discover here, rediscover here, I should say.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Keith. And that reminds me, Grace, you've written, since your book came out, actually, you wrote a piece over this year of COVID. It seems like some people are doing what Keith ended up doing. And I don't know about his time frame there, but people are now maybe looking more at going back to that smaller town, hometown. What are we seeing out there?
It's really interesting looking at the data. About 52% of adults aged about 18 to 29 moved back in or were living with their parents in 2020. That's the largest share since the Great Depression, according to the Pew Research Center. And in addition, if you look at rural migration data for counties of about 250,000 people or less from 2016, 17, and 18, you also saw a pretty sizable in-migration of people, enough to match or surpass out-migration most of the time. And so there were a lot of people moving into these small rural communities. And I think that it's really interesting to see how many of those are what Wes Jackson of the Land Institute has called homecomers, people who saw themselves as returning to a community that they had roots in and that they wanted to be a part of going forward.
Thanks a lot for that call. Grace, in our last couple minutes or so, what is your advice for that person who is in that small community and loves it and wants to put it on people's radar in a positive way? How can they help root themselves and others?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, wherever you are, I love the quote. It's from a guy named Jim Elliott. Wherever you are, be all there. I've loved getting involved in my community here in Virginia. I'm on the tree board. I love being able to participate in town council meetings and to help ministries. And I think that that's the sort of work that's going to continue to strengthen whatever community you're in. But in addition to that, I think it's very important that we continue to emphasize the fact that our places, even if they're struggling, have a lot of inherent beauty and value, and that we should love them for what they are and try to make them stronger. Supporting small businesses, of course, is a very vital thing in this time of COVID, as many local businesses and business owners have struggled. And I'm hopeful that we can kind of resurrect some of that love of the local and of those places as people are moving back to rural America, and hopefully see some neat entrepreneurial opportunities open up as a result.
We'll leave it there. Grace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you to all the people who called in as well.
Yeah, definitely. Grace Olmsted is a journalist who focuses on farming, localism, and family. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Uprooted: Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind. Still time for you to share your story, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you moved away and came back or are thinking about it. That's on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Governor Evers signed off on a new casino development in Beloit. We'll look back at the long road to approval and the possible impact that project could have on the southern Wisconsin community. Vaccines have a long history in the U.S., so does resistance to vaccines. A public health expert looks back at past disputes over vaccinations, and it's this week's edition of Food Friday with some easy and delicious home recipes. That's tomorrow on Central Time. It's a big time of year for people who love audio. Yesterday, the library